Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Get ready to hear the truth about America on a show that's not immune to the facts with your host, Dan Bongino.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This is a special podcast we put together for you to enjoy on Sundays. It features some of the interviews we did on my radio show during the week with some terrific guests, and we just like you to hear it. So you can hear these live during the week in your local radio station. You can find out on my website where you can listen, Bongino.com. Click on Station Finder. If you're looking for a firearm that's easy to transport, you got to check out the U.S. Survival Rifle from Henry Repeating Arms. It's a portable rifle you can put together and take apart in a few minutes. And then when you're not using it, you can store the parts in the little case it comes in. It's so small, it can be stored anywhere, in a go bag, anywhere. It's light enough to carry everywhere. Comes in black and two different camo patterns. You can pick one up for $300 to $400, depending on the finish. You can watch a few videos at henryusa.com/survival. And while you're there, be sure to order their free catalog. Henry makes more than 200 rifles, shotguns, and revolvers, and they're all made in America, backed by a lifetime satisfaction guarantee and the best customer service in the business. Go to their website. It's henryusa.com, and be sure to order a free catalog. They'll send it with free decals and a list of dealers in your area. That's henryusa.com for a free catalog and decals and to see the Henry U.S. Survival Rifle. First up, today's interview with Victor Davis Hanson. We got his thoughts on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what he thinks may happen, and what our response should be. Take a listen. All right, here he is. All right. Welcoming back, well, not back, for the first time to the show. I interviewed this gentleman once before when I used to guest host at WMAL. So welcoming back to the Dan Bongino Show, just not this one, Victor Davis Hanson. Thanks for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Sure, and you can check him out at victorhanson.com for his writings, his books. They're terrific. Sir, first question for you today. You know, the variables here, as I've been discussing in my first hour of the show, are nearly endless. And the problem we have is there's a certain predictability that's gone out the window with Vladimir Putin. I mean, even for an international despot like Kim Jong-un, we can generally figure out what he's not going to do. It appears right now with Putin that that's getting more difficult. I mean, a lot of people with a lot of experience in the region seem to think he wouldn't invade outside of eastern Ukraine and did it anyway. Do you see him as being irrational or unpredictable, or do you have a different viewpoint on that?
I have a little different. I think he's pretty predictable. I think the only thing that was unexpected is that the initial 48 hours or 3 days, even, he didn't use the full extent of his power to crush the Ukrainian resistance. He underestimated. He thought it would be analogous to eastern Ukraine or Crimea or Georgia, where it was pretty easy. But I think the way he figures is that he's going to pour in everything he has and crush the Ukrainians. And in a month from now, when you or I talk to people, we won't remember the initial difficulty. We'll only be supposedly, in his mind, impressed by Russian power and decisiveness. And this will send a signal to everybody in the former Soviet Union that are not part of Mother Russia that this was the lesson. And I think he underestimated the resistance, and he underestimated NATO coming together and the flip-flop of Germany. But in his mind, he still thinks it's not hopeless. He's going to win, and then in his real politic world, savage world, all that matters is winning. And nobody will care about the details, how he won or the difficulty, how he won a year from now, a month from now. So I'm kind of skeptical of all these people who are, you know, rallying and saying, I wish it were true, but they're saying, oh, he's going to lose and there's going to be a coup and they're going to get rid of him and he's destroyed the economy. That could happen. But for the short term, at least, if he wins with this renewed use of power, in his calculations, he can still salvage the whole Ukrainian project. I hope he doesn't, but that's how I think he thinks. And that's kind of predictable, I think.
We're talking to Victor Davis Hanson. You can check out his writings and his work at victorhanson.com. So what do you make of his escalating nuclear rhetoric? You think it's a bluff? I mean, again, a lot of folks miscalculated with a lot of experience dealing with the region who thought, as I said before, he would just stick with the eastern region of Ukraine and not go any further. That clearly was not the case. You know, given a black swan event like a nuclear attack, it's not the type of thing we can just cast off and disregard. Your take on why he's escalating the nuclear rhetoric?
Oh, I think he realizes that in every incursion, invasion, the key to whether you win or lose are borders. And we lost in Vietnam because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail into Southeast Asia, supply depots. We had a tough time. We literally lost in Afghanistan because of the Pakistan border and Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Anytime you have that fluidity and you can be resupplied, you're not going to win. And he's looking at the statistics. It's in the many thousands now of Javelins and SAMs that have been sent in there. And you look at that picture of that convoy. And in theory, those Javelins, the new improved, can hit something at over 2 miles. And a guy could be in the forest beyond the, you know, the flanking infantry guards of that convoy and take out a lot of vehicles if they have that many of them. So he's thinking, well, I've got to get this over with and win. And these people, we've got four NATO countries that are going to stop me. And so I'm going to threaten a nuclear strike on the West. When you look, you know, people have remarked about the look of his generals when he said that. I don't know if that's indicative of anything, but I think there are.
Yeah, I don't either. I think that was more propaganda than anything. I mean, you don't know what they were thinking. The guy could have just gotten out of his kid's birthday party and had a funky look on his face. No, I agree with you 100%. Sorry, go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Yeah, I just think there's certain things I wish we didn't do. You remember the hot mic in Seoul, South Korea in March of 2012? And I really wish Obama hadn't have had that quid pro quo where we dismantled the missile defense. Ostensibly, it was to protect Eastern Europe against Iran. But right now, if we had a joint missile defense to hit missiles on their initial trajectory in Eastern Europe, that would have been a deterrent. We just gave that up for nothing. I shouldn't say nothing. We gave it up so for Obama's request to have flexibility in space so that he, you know, after he could get reelected, then I guess he was saying that Putin could do what he wanted, but not in 2012. And he was willing to dismantle what had been a pretty good project that had just started to begin. But I think we have enough deterrence. U.S. nuclear strategic doctrine is a little different. We have the ability and accuracy and the multiplicity of platforms that the Russians, as the Soviets, knew that we could take a first strike and they could not. So the generals will tell him, if you were to be so stupid to send a missile or a lot of them to take out American sites, they have the ability to wipe us off the map. And that's not counting the 250 or 300 nukes that France and the UK have. So I don't think it's a serious threat, but anytime you even mention that, you got to take it seriously.
The conversation Nassim Taleb sparks online, his book The Black Swan, woke me up to that fact. You know, if someone told you, oh, don't worry, there's only a 1 in 100 chance this plane's going to crash, you know, you're not going to get on the plane, right? I mean, yeah, maybe a black swan event, but the consequences of the wrong decision are terminal. It's death. So I agree with you on that. You know, one of the things that's frustrated me, and I always eagerly look forward to your appearances on Tucker Carlson's show, is you have this just almost unparalleled ability. I don't see another commentator out there outside of maybe Thomas Sowell to get into the mind of the left and what they're doing and explain it in common sense terms. What I find puzzling amongst the left, where even the European Greens are waking up now, Victor, is this energy suicide pact. Where we're like, hey, listen, we're the left. We believe in tolerance and all that other cutesy coexist stuff. But we're going to let Putin invade a neighbor who was, you know, almost no threat to them, at least in the short term. We claim to believe in human rights when we could have probably done a lot to mitigate the threat if we just would have produced a good amount of energy here, even though we have stricter energy guidelines. But no, not our left. They turned that over to Putin, enriched him, and really, you know, empowered this guy seeking his international hegemony right here. It just seems bizarre. It's almost suicidal.
It is. I've had the misfortune for 40 years of having to associate every day with leftists in academia. And I can tell you, as you know from John Kerry's remark the other day, that, I mean, he was completely dense, that he was worried most not about death on a mass scale, but whether climate change talks with Putin would now be sidetracked. So what I'm getting at is, never underestimate the left's arrogance. They really do believe that their eloquence, their mellifluousness, their superior morality, there are no external foreign threats. You can always talk and sway and persuade a Putin. And I know that that sounds crazy, but it's borne out by facts, because if you think of everything that we did to appease Putin, it was all from the left. It was the Russian reset. It was use of Russian sources to create the Steele dossier. It was Uranium One. It was getting Bill Clinton to go to Moscow, pay him $500,000. It was the Hunter Biden consortium going to Russia, Ukraine, China. It was the massive donations from Russian sources to the Clinton Foundation. And it was all predicated on, we're going to go over there with our Harvard and Yale degrees and really tell these Russians that it's in their interest to be nice to us and to create an ecumenical global vision. And that's what they think. And then the green thing, they never even think of the strategic, or it's just a minor irritant, because if it arose, and it did, they think they could just, you know, get Vladimir and the Putin and say, let's be flexible, Vladimir, give me some space. And that's what they do, and they get people killed by that. What's interesting is the complete flip-flop of Germany. So the German chancellor gets on there, and it's like, we're going to be an arm now. We're going to meet more than our 2%. We're going to give weapons, which we never have, to a third party. We're going to start building conventional power plants. And what that reflected was that everything that they have said for the last 20 years against all that, against conventional energy, against the 2% goal in NATO, against NATO itself, against the United States, they knew it was never really valid, because they just abandoned it all without any apology to us. They didn't never said, we're sorry that we demonized you for enforcing the 2%. We're sorry that we said you were always a warmonger when you gave weapons to third party. We're sorry when you said that the pipeline was bad and you sanctioned it. And so you can see that the left has been, they've been repudiated. And I think here they're in full panic, because this Ukrainian thing and the flip-flop of Germany and the threats of Putin, as you say, it's all predicated, if you trace it back, to energy. And they're responsible for giving him petrodollars by spiking the world price, for making us vulnerable, for making Europe vulnerable. That whole ideology has done this. And when you think of the corollaries to it, that only 45%, Dan, have confidence now, according to a recent poll, in the U.S. military. And that's because of Afghanistan, and that's because of the wokeness and Milley and Austin and their obsessions with white anger. And what they've done is, the left, is they've removed the deterrence of the U.S. military. And then we have to throw in, you know, Biden with Afghanistan and telling the hackers in Russia, lay off 16 sites, otherwise go ahead, and begging Putin to produce oil. So it's a left. They own this. They own the lack of deterrence. They own the green suicidal policies, and they don't know what to do. And now they're reduced to the ridiculous. They're actually blaming Donald Trump. They say between 2017 and 20, it's true, he didn't go into anywhere, but Putin did, because he got everything from Donald Trump. He wanted. So why go in? And I'm thinking, wow, they really like Trump killing mercenaries. They really like Trump crashing world prices, increasing the defense budget, you name it, getting out of a missile deal with them. It's absurd, but that's what they're reduced to, because they're desperate.
Yeah, what about the Open Skies Treaty? You know, Trump pulled out of that, too. The Russians wanted that. That wasn't benefiting us anymore. That was Trump. Victor, I got to run, unfortunately, but I so deeply appreciate you coming on. I really look forward to your appearances on cable news. Thanks a lot for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
You got it. Folks, you can check him out at victorhanson.com, and I strongly encourage you to do so. You won't see the... You won't see a large group of people out there have the ability he does to get inside the mind of the left. Jim, wouldn't you agree? I know you love VDH there. That's our first time. We got to get him back sometime. Let's line him up for round two if we can. Huh? That was Victor Davis Hanson, who was on the radio show with some incredible insight on the conflict in Ukraine. We've got another great interview coming up with Dr. Peter McCullough about some eye-opening information about the Pfizer vaccine you need to hear about. You don't want to miss this.
With cyber attacks on the rise, protecting your data security is more important than ever. So why is Congress considering a law that puts your data at greater risk of being hacked and exposed to foreign networks? The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill shifts billions in consumer spending to less secure payment networks, all so that corporate megastores can make bigger profits. Don't let Durbin-Marshall steal your data. Visit handsoffmyrewards.com/security and tell your senators to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Okay, here's Dr. Peter McCullough, who brought to light information about the Pfizer vaccine, a study, and what it may be doing in your body. Please pay really close attention to this interview. All right, the doctor's very busy here, so let me not waste a lot of time and get right to him. This is Dr. Peter McCullough. Doctor, thanks for spending some time with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Doctor, I read this study. I saw it on your social media feed about the intracellular reverse transcription of the Pfizer COVID-19 mRNA vaccine. Can you explain to us in layman's terms what this means? It sounds to me like our bodies could be incentivized to produce this spike protein a lot longer than anticipated. And if true, that could cause a lot of complications. Am I wrong?
That's true. I mean, the concerning new news on this is that a lab in Sweden now has found the cell line that indeed a lot of this has to do with laboratory technique, the cell line that has demonstrated the fact that the vaccine's now in the cytoplasm, in the area where the messenger RNA should be transcribed in order to produce the spike protein, that in fact it sits there long enough for DNA to be laid down against the RNA, and that DNA moves into the nucleus of the cell. And with that, it's found in the nucleus, and it's coding for the spike protein. Now, we don't know if it's actually physically changing the chromosomes permanently, but many believe that that is circumstantial evidence that that's happening. Now there's going to be a really hot and heavy investigation to see whether or not these vaccines, in fact, permanently change chromosomes. And if this is the case, is spike protein going to be produced long term?
Does any other vaccine, we're talking to Dr. Peter McCullough, does any other vaccine do that, lead to long-term chromosomal changes that you're aware of, or is this new technology the first one to your knowledge?
It's new technology, and that's the consequences of using new technology in a widespread vaccine program, is these things are not, you know, cannot be assessed ahead of time in enough preclinical studies. Now, the respiratory illness itself has been shown, and particularly in severe cases where there's prolonged exposure, to have some reverse transcription. We don't know what the implications are. When you get a natural viral infection, some of it can incorporate it in your own DNA. It's called the HERV region. And you may know this because if you get chickenpox, the virus doesn't install, and later on in life you can get shingles, which is the varicella zoster virus coming back out. The same thing is true with Epstein-Barr virus. You get a permanent install. But with a vaccine, there's just under no circumstances would we want to see evidence of a permanent install, particularly on production of a protein, which is pathogenic.
Doctor, we're talking to Dr. Peter McCullough about a troubling new study. Once we hang up, I'll show you folks where you can read it for yourself. For a guy like me who's, you know, recently, hopefully, recovered from lymphoma, I'm in remission now, and my wife, who has an autoimmune disorder herself and lupus, if that turns out to be the case, and I understand it's a preliminary study, you know, you were very cautious in your approach to it as well, But if it turns out that we are producing spike proteins long term, what could that mean for people with autoimmune difficulties and people with various types of cancers, blood cancers, and immune system cancers?
I think it's going to be a matter of degree. If it's one or two shots and it's a mosaic of cells and there isn't much passage to daughter cells, you know, this thing can, in a sense, burn itself out or be cleared out over time. Bruce Patterson, who leads a company called Incell DX, doing terrific work. He's formerly a professor at Northwestern and Stanford. He's actually shown in the respiratory illness that the spike protein is in the body a long time, Dan, up to 15 months in CD16 positive monocytes. And I did have him on my show, and I asked him about what is he seeing in vaccinated people. And in fact, he does have samples. He's seen both the S1 and the S2 segment of the spike protein in humans after vaccination as long as he's observed them. So for months, and I asked him, I said, can you predict how long it's in the body? He said, probably over a year. You know, SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and then the spike protein installed in the body with vaccination, it has a persistence in the body. That's the reason why people feel bad. There's a long COVID syndrome. And I asked him, is there any other infection that's similar to this? He said, yeah, there is. I said, what is it? He said, Lyme disease. Lyme disease does an install of the organism called Borrelia burgdorferi. It takes forever to clear out Lyme. That's the reason why people get this post-Lyme syndrome. So I think people who are immune deficient, people with lymphoma, they've had chemotherapy or radiation, or they have other autoimmune illnesses, this could be a problem. And I think doctors will have to keep a careful watch on organ systems that could be involved, including the bone marrow, measures of the immune system, brain and heart. And let's hope for the best. But none of this is adding up to having people get enrolled in a periodic booster program. I think that could be trouble.
Doc, do you have time for one more question? I know you're crunched for time. You're seeing patients. One more, and we'll let you go. This is where I'm having a hard time reconciling this as again a non-medical professional like yourself. If the research turns out to be accurate in vivo, and we start getting, say, liver samples from people, and starts to show that yes, spike proteins are being pumped out for a longer term than anticipated, then how is it that the vaccine's effectiveness is waning so poorly? In other words, if it's pumping out these spike proteins that are supposed to be recognized as by our bodies as foreign invaders, then and we're producing antibodies, then why is the vaccine, you get what I'm saying? Like, it's producing these spike proteins, but it's not doing what it's supposed to do. Doesn't seem to make sense. It would seem to be zero sum here. One would take away from the other.
That's a brilliant observation. So your question is, you know, if we're being presented with this antigen all the time, why don't we have these rock and rolling antibodies, right? Why do they trail off? In a paper by Israel, done in Israel, he's the first author, they showed a 40% drop off per month of these antibodies after the vaccine. It must be, and I think Bruce Patterson is right on this, it must be that the body is concealing the spike protein as an antigen because your white blood cells, your monocytes and macrophages are trying to gobble up the spike protein. So in a sense, you're sequestering it away from antigenic presentation, but yet you're stuck with this over time. So let's hope that it's not a chronic stimulus for blood clots. It's not a chronic stimulus for myocarditis or heart inflammation that evolves over time, or bleeding disorders like vaccine-induced thrombocytopenic purpura. And let's hope that it's not a stimulus for cancer. And the first cancer data was presented out of the Department of Defense Epidemiologic Database, DMED, and that was at the January 24th Senate hearings, where it's just epidemiological, but there has been a market increase in cancer among our service people right now, year on year, since the vaccines have been rolled out. And this is part of the problem when we get into a very accelerated course of approval and get a product out into widespread use without its study. This type of program should have had years and years of study because it's new genetic technology.
Dr. Peter McCullough, can't thank you enough for, I go to your social media feed for accurate science-based data, and I really appreciate you not being intimidated by people trying to shut you down for speaking the truth. So thanks for spending some time with us during your extremely busy workday. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Bye.
That was an incredible interview with Dr. Peter McCullough. Up next, we talk with Sebastian Gorka, but first, Here's Sebastian Gorka from the radio show last week about the crisis in Ukraine and the feckless Biden administration. All right, welcoming back to the show a guy who I trust and value his opinion a lot, especially on national security matters, former assistant to President Trump, a man you know well, Sebastian Gorka. Sebastian, thank you very much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
I'm honored, Dan. It's a real pleasure to be on your show. I know it's sad that you're not with us on Salem, but you're keeping millions of people safe every day. So thank you, Dan, for what you do.
Oh, thanks, buddy. If you want to learn more about Sebastian and his content, read his content over there, sebgorka.com, sebgorka.com. Check it out. So, Sebastian, obviously a somber day. Woke up this morning. I think we all expected it, but a lot of folks, me included, expected a limited incursion into eastern Ukraine, not what appears to be now a full-scale invasion from the north, from the south. It appears they took power plants. It appears they're taking the airport now in Kiev. This looks to be a full-scale invasion. Your opinion, you're a national security expert, worked in the White House with President Trump. Do you think he plans on occupying Ukraine? And I can't imagine that works out well for him. This is a rather large country.
It is a large country, and it has a great tradition after it was swallowed up of fighting the Soviets for years and years in the forest. So I'm not worried about the Ukrainians taking the fight in internal guerrilla warfare to the Soviet invaders or the Russian invaders today. But yes, no, he has really jumped the shark, to use the vernacular. When he gave that verbal diarrhea of a fake history lesson just a couple of days ago, he said, well, you know, Ukraine never been an independent country. It's always been part of Russia. And the scary thing is, Dan, that he has done exactly the same thing over the years with the Baltic states and even Poland. So this is an individual who has said publicly on more than one occasion that the greatest geostrategic tragedy, quote-unquote, of the 20th century was the loss of the Soviet Union. So in some delusional, deranged fashion, this is his attempt to try and piece it back together through the use of force.
We're talking to Sebastian Gorka. You can check him out at sebgorka.com. Good man, good friend, folks. We got to support our guys who are in this fight to win. Sebastian, you just brought up something about the Baltic states and obviously NATO members in the region. You know, there were some reports earlier of Putin's forces hitting Snake Island, which is an island closer to Romania, candidly, that is Ukraine, yeah. Although Ukraine had an outpost out there, which had the Romanians on high alert. You know, again, I'm putting myself in the camp that would have never seen him attacking a NATO country, Ukraine, of course, not being in NATO. I really thought it would be a limited incursion to the east. Do you see him doing that? I mean, what's this guy's end game? I mean, if he hits a NATO country, obviously it triggers Article 5 and puts us in a treaty box that, treaty-wise, at least we're obligated to respond.
I cannot predict what a psychotic authoritarian head of state will do. It's hard to get inside that soulless mind. Why? Well, this is a former KGB colonel. This is an individual who has, assassinated or attempt to assassinate people on foreign soil, such as UK citizens in the Skripal assault. This is a man who kills journalists on his own territory who criticize him. But at the end of the day, you know, you're a big film guy, Dan. I love all your culture references, pop culture.
you know that
scene from the Hunt for Red October where Congressman Fred Thompson is playing the admiral on the aircraft carrier? Yep. And Jack Ryan walks out of the XO's office or the admiral's wardroom, and then he looks to his XO and he says, "This will get out of hand very, very quickly."
This I remember that scene well.
You remember that scene? That
yeah, of course.
Without the calculation of an actual territorial aggression against a NATO neighbor, a NATO nation. Why? The Ukraine already borders NATO nations like Hungary. The concept that this couldn't happen by accident or that Russian troops don't get carried away by themselves, that's why we need strong leadership more than ever. And NATO right now, Dan, is talking about sanctions. Sanctions have never stopped Vladimir Putin from doing anything. When we were in the White House, instead of sending socks
and blankets to Kiev. What did we do? We didn't invade Russia. We're not, you know, the kinds of interventionists of the neoconservative ilk. We just sent Javelin missiles to Ukraine so they could deal with the threat themselves. But what is Biden going to do? So this is a man who told us Putin is afraid of me. Really, Joe? I've just listened, literally, 3 minutes before I came on, I listened to Boris Johnson and the Labour opposition head in Parliament agree together on how this is egregious and what measures have to be taken. Biden hasn't even spoken yet. Every head of state has given statements. Right. Where is Biden, Dan?
Sebastian, that is a wonderful question, and I was following Boris Johnson's comments closely. Boris Johnson is about 10 degrees hotter on this than Biden. Boris Johnson is saying now that cutting them out of SWIFT, the international payment clearance system, is not off the table. Meanwhile, Biden's dilly-dallying, and he's also saying, hey, our next step is we're not going to let a damn Russian plane land anywhere in the UK. I mean, Biden's got to, I agree with you, we don't have to put our boots on the ground, but you got to do something. I mean, really, don't just sit there playing tiddlywinks.
Boris has banned all Russian companies from the British financial system. Think about that. What did Biden do day one? One of his first executive orders was to shut down the XL Keystone pipeline extension. When we were in the White House, for the first time in the Republic's history, we were a net exporter of energy. The biggest thing we did to hurt Vladimir Putin is become a net exporter of oil and gas. Fracking is being shut down. XL shut down. Nord Stream was permitted. The Nord Stream pipeline was permitted by Biden. And you know the strange situation I'm in, and you know, as a former Secret Service guy, you understand this. I keep getting asked, what would you tell Biden to do right now? Nothing, because it makes no difference. We need Donald Trump back in the White House. When you have a weak, feckless, senile old man, it doesn't matter what he does, because Putin has got his number. And when you have an elite from Rice to Kamala, the cackler, to Biden, who detest America, Dan, that's the common issue. They hate America, and that's why they will never do the right thing. And I'm not an interventionist, but here's the lesson for my fellow conservatives, everybody, guys. When a bully, go back to the playground when you're a kid, when a bully is allowed to get away with bullying, sooner or later, everybody pays the price.
Yeah, we're talking to Sebastian Gorka. His website, sebgorka.com. Sebastian, you were in the White House with President Trump. You were a national security expert. You taught it. You know, I have a theory here, and listen, you have no obligation whatsoever to agree with me. If you think it's stupid, tell me. You will not hurt my feelings. You're certainly a better expert than me on this. But, you know, there's an element of unpredictability that can be strategic when it comes to warfare. I mean, you see it all the time with people like Kim Jong-un and the Iranians, who managed to stay in power, but despite being dramatically weaker than the combined world's military. And the world, the reason is because nobody knows what the hell they're going to do. I mean, they're totally unpredictable. The problem I have with Biden, in contrast to your former boss and our president, Donald Trump, is nobody knew what Donald Trump was going to do. Remember the Russian mercs he annihilated in the Syrian battlefield? They didn't see that coming, Sebastian. They went through the proper deconfliction, and they told the Russians, the Trump administration, through Mattis, they said, listen, you get these Russian mercs out of there, we're going to kill them. And the Russians basically said, go F yourself. You're not going to kill our guys. And you know what we did? We killed them. They killed 90 Russian mercs and 100 others. I mean, listen, I'm not reveling in anyone's death. I'm just telling you, like, no one could predict what this guy was going to do. And you know what Russia did in response to that? Nothing. They did nothing. Now, here's Biden on the other hand. Not only predictable, but he tells Putin in that dreadful speech, he says, listen, if you invade eastern Ukraine in a minor incursion, we'll all be fighting about what to do, basically. I mean, strategic unpredictability matters, doesn't it?
You nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. It's like Sun Tzu said more than 2,000 years ago, the greatest form of victory is to win without fighting. You have so got to screw with the will of the enemy that they don't know if you're going to go nuclear on their backside. Think of this. He's having a state-like dinner at Mar-a-Lago with the biggest communist dictator in the world, Xi Jinping, and over chocolate cake, Dan. He whispers.
Yeah, this is a great story. Wait, this is a great story. I got him. Sebastian, folks, listen to this story he's about to tell you. Let me prep the battlefield. Sebastian's about to tell you a story about Donald Trump. He's having dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping when he's president. Tell everybody what happened. This is the best story.
So they've had the dinner in the beautiful Mar-a-Lago club where the president lives. They've served this amazing, the best chocolate cake in the world, Dan. and he just through the interpreter, leans over to Xi Jinping and says, oh, by the way, I just dropped 52 cruise missiles on Assad's head because he was going to use chemical weapons again in Syria. And I can't, you know, I have my TS clearances. I had them back then. I can tell you, Dan, I saw the intel. He was going to move chemical weapons from that airbase in Syria, and we dropped 52 cruise missiles on his head. Not because we're interventionists, not because we talk about invading other countries, but when bad guys do bad things that are unconscionable, we send a message of strength. And that message wasn't just for Xi, that was for Putin. That was for little Kim. That was for the mullahs. And I can't, you know, he has done other things off the record, directly with Vlad, to send a very similar message. And I'm so glad you mentioned what you mentioned. Let's be clear. The Russia collusion, really? We almost brought Russia to its knees because of our energy independence. And for the first time in our republic's history, not even the great Ronald Reagan did this. President Trump gave the green light to the SecDef to target 200 Russian mercs in Syria who weren't mercs. They were special operators working directly for Vlad, and we gave them a dirt nap. Not because he wanted to invade Syria, because we said, you're not going to mess in the Middle East when I'm the commander-in-chief. That's leadership. And right now, Biden couldn't do that if his life depended on it, Dan.
Yeah, you can't. That the largest loss of Russian life in American hands in decades. And people forget that story. You know why they forget it? Because the media never told you the story because it made Trump look tough on Russia. So they hid it. That's what happened. Sebastian, last question for you. I'm talking to Sebastian Gorka, SebGorka.com. I got about 2 minutes left. You know, one of the lessons learned from the Iraq war, I've learned from military strategist friends of mine, is never go to war with the United States without nuclear weapons. You basically stand no chance. Do you think in 1994, when Bill Clinton and others around the world convinced the Ukrainians to give up their nuclear weapons in Budapest, that looks like a mistake now, doesn't it?
This is perhaps one of the most tragic aspects of the current situation in America. When we were in the White House, we had a very simple message that we stole from the Marine Corps. No better friend, no worse enemy. After 8 years of Obama and Biden treating our friends like Israel as enemies and facilitating our enemies like Iran, giving them $140 billion, we reversed that. And we reversed it in a matter of months. Remember, we took out the ISIS caliphate in 5 months after Obama said it would be with us for generations. It is possible to reverse this, but not unless we get engaged. Listen to Dan, get engaged, get politically active. I don't care if it's the local school board or the local, you know, council, the local library council. Get engaged. We can take back America. We did it in Virginia, but it's up to us. In the meantime, Biden is going to drive this issue into the ground. Find out more. I've got an exclusive interview with President Trump. It's the first appendix of my book, The War for America's Soul. But guys, it is up to us. When America leads, the world is a safer place. Right now, we are more dangerous globally. The situation is more dangerous than it has been since 1945. And that's on every single person who voted for Biden. Period. End of story.
Yeah. Well said. Sebastian Gorka, thank you very much for your service to the country. Thank you for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it.
You too, buddy. God bless you and your listeners.
That was our interview with Sebastian Gorka from the radio show last week. You can hear me every weekday across the country on over 300 radio stations. Go to Bongino.com and click on Station Finder to find out where I'm on near you. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it.
You just heard Dan Bongino.